recognized it at first there. Yeah. There it is. Sunday nights, HBO. One of the most iconic shows in television history that in many ways was the kickoff to this new golden age of TV. The Sopranos debuted on HBO 20 years ago. Our friend Alan Sepinwall has written extensively about the show in his columns at the Newark Star-Ledger and, of course, in his book, TV the Book, along with Matt Zoller's Sites. And we had a chance to catch up with Alan last week and talk about his red-hot bestseller, The Sopranos Session, so hot that Amazon actually ran out of the book. But they're back now. They have them. You can get them, order them from Amazon, get them from your local independent bookseller as well. And we had a great conversation with Alan talking about how this was, a return to roots for he and Matt back when they were the TV critics for Tony Soprano's hometown newspaper.
We were writing for the Star-Ledger of Newark, New Jersey before the show even debuted. They reached out to us back when they were first making the pilot, just for help producing those fake copies of the newspaper that Tony would get at the end of his driveway. And, you know, we realized immediately, oh, this is going to be a big deal if the show shot in our circulation area, set in our circulation area. As it turned out, our editor had gone to Rutgers with James Gandolfini. So there's a lot of different connections there. I grew up one town over from David Chase, the show's creator. So we were embedded with the series pretty much from beginning to end. So it was nice to be able to return to that and bring things a little full circle with this book.
By the way, I feel like I should get an honorary subscription to the Star-Ledger from having you on. We've had Mark Deano on talking about his wonderful new novel, and Jerry Eisenberg's been on a couple times with us.
Mark and Jerry are great. Mark is the guy I was talking about.
Yeah.
He went to Rutgers with Jim. They were on the freshman dorm together, and you remember that big dent in Jim's forehead?
Yes.
Mark put it there when they were horsing around. He slammed a door in his face during a game of darts or something.
I love that story. Well, we knew this was going to be a different type of TV series 20 years ago, and different than even what we thought it would be, as you point out in the book, right from the opening credits.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, every mob show to that point, every mob movie had been a story of New York wise guys or Chicago wise guys. This was a New Jersey suburban wise guy. The SUV rumbles out of the Lincoln Tunnel going west away from the city. And, you know, it goes into these neighborhoods that I had grown up in and these stores I had shopped at and that, you know, a lot of our readers had. It was really different and exciting.
And so much of what we think of as fairly commonplace in episodic television today had its roots with The Sopranos.
Yeah, it's basically the most influential scripted TV show since maybe I Love Lucy. If you look at the way television looks in the year 2019 at Netflix, at Amazon, at HBO, FX, you know, Game of Thrones, all Walking Dead, Breaking Bad, all of these shows that have come in the years since then that are more serialized, that are more ambiguous in terms of narrative, in terms of morality, that challenge their viewers in different ways. These would not exist in the form that they do if not for the success of this show.
Well, I absolutely love the structure of the book, and it begins with the recaps and going through every single episode from all seven seasons. Great to revisit those and your thoughts and Matt's thoughts, but also to be reminded that there's some great television in there, but not everyone was gold.
No, it doesn't always work. It's definitely a more uneven show than a lot of the ones that followed it. You know, Breaking Bad is a much more narratively tight show than The Sopranos was. You know, so there's some characters that don't work, some subplots, whole episodes like the Columbus Day one. But when it works, my goodness, the big worry about doing this book was it had been a long time since I'd watched the show. And I worried, like, okay, we're going to look at this and it's going to feel like some dusty old relic full of cliches that have, you know, been copied again and again in the 20 years since the show debuted. And I liked it even better most of the time when I was watching it. It was fantastic.
Well, and everybody's got their own list. It's hard to pick one, but a list of favorite episodes high on my list because of the main connection is college. And I think that's the episode where I reached out to everybody I knew and said, if you're not watching this show, why are you not watching? You've got to see what happened in Maine.
No, that's entirely the episode where The Sopranos became the phenomenon that we think of now. Because the first four episodes of the show, they were very good, but the reviews had been strong, but not overwhelmingly so, and I don't think that critics have been given that one yet. And the morning after that episode aired, that's when I started hearing from people exactly like you saying those things like, have you heard about The Sopranos show? You really got to see it. I can't believe what they did last night.
Well, and because that's also the episode, as you point out, where we had grown to like this guy, and we knew that, that Tony was not a good guy, but he was also pretty likable. And then when he does what he did in that episode, now you're faced with the choices you've made as a viewer as well.
Yeah, and David Chase, the creator of the show, had to fight to do that. We did these long set of new interviews for the book about it, and he said he had to fight with HBO. HBO begged him not to do it, said, if you show him killing this guy, you're going to lose the audience. And Chase's argument was, if he doesn't kill the guy, that's how we're going to lose the audience, because they're going to think he's a phony, and, you know, and he was right.
What's your favorite? Maybe not the best episode, but the one that rings true for you more than others?
I mean, Pine Barrens is certainly the most rewatchable over and over again, the one where Christopher and Paulie are lost in the woods. It's just this perfect little standalone episode and very funny in addition to everything else. But, I mean, I kind of have to go with stuff from the first season, like the season one finale where Tony goes to confront his mother. That relationship, I think, is still the strongest one that the show had throughout its entire run, and the climax there where he grabs the pillow as he's going to see her in the nursing home is just extraordinary. And another one that I love is Long-Term Parking from season 5, which is the end of the Adriana story, which is the show was not usually interested in just being a straightforward mob drama, even though a lot of the audience, that's all that they wanted from it. But when it did it in an episode like that, it was just spectacular.
One of the great parts of the book, and we'll talk about it more, are your conversations, several of them with David Chase. And, well, he got right to it when you asked him about the inspiration for Livia Soprano. No doubt about where that came from.
That was his mother. The whole idea for the show came from David Chase spending years telling friends these crazy stories about his difficult relationship with his mother, and they would always laugh. And finally, his wife Denise said, David, you've got to make a show out of this. And he couldn't figure out how to do it until he heard like that Paramount wanted him to maybe make a TV version of The Godfather, which he wisely did not want to do, but it made him realize, oh, well, what if I do, you know, the difficult mother of a mob boss? And it worked.
We're talking with Alan Sepinwall. The book is The Sopranos Sessions that he's written along with Matt Zoller-Seitz. I wonder, because it changed so much about television and what you guys were doing at the time in writing about it and focusing on individual episodes, did the weekly schedule, the broadcast schedule from HBO, and even the layoffs between seasons make it more primed for that kind of in-depth analysis and the analysis that viewers of the show did that you can't do today as easily when shows drop a whole season at a time on Netflix or Hulu and the way a lot of people watch TV today?
Yeah, that's a very big difference, and it really worked in The Sopranos' favor. Also, the fact that there were not nearly as many shows like it in terms of tone or aspiration, whether or not they were as good. So it kind of had the field all to itself, and it had a week in between episodes and sometimes a year between seasons. So you could have a lot of speculation and a lot of talk, and now everything just comes in a rush. And even shows that will air weekly on an HBO or an FX or whatever, there's a lot of people who just wait to binge them later. So everyone's watching on their own schedule, whereas back in the day it was, oh my God, I can't believe what they did to Ralphie. And you didn't have to worry about, you know, spoiling your coworkers or everything because they had watched it the same night you had.
Well, the analysis that you guys do is so tremendous in this, including the symbolism. That's such a big part of this show, from the number 7 to the images that appear. And to me, that's one of the things I loved about the series and love about the book. It's in the days. I go back to the days of vinyl when we would re-listen to albums over and over again and look for what we thought were those messages hidden deep in the lyrics somewhere. And it's that same kind of thing.
It is, and this sort of kicked off something similar to that rock revolution in the 60s and 70s where you start, like, passing around the DVDs, like people would, you know, give out old albums and say, man, you got to see this. You got to really dig deep. There's so much there. And it's one of the two or three shows I always had the most fun writing about because every episode was so layered and so dense with meaning, and there's so many different ways you can analyze, you know, every story and every scene.
The David Chase sessions are tremendous and, of course, got a lot of attention when the first book came up because some people believed that David Chase was giving away an answer to the long-asked question in there. But when you read the interviews, it's a bit more ambiguous than that. He had plans, certainly, but it ended the way he and the writers and everybody involved wanted it to end.
Yeah, there was this, as a member of the media, I should have been prepared for this, but I guess I wasn't. Whereas the story kind of got aggregated and it turned into a game of telephone where people started reporting something that was not what he had said, and then other people were reporting that, not even having read the book, but just having read the other stories. The short version is he talked about a different idea for the end of the show that would have much more clearly pointed to the death of Tony Soprano as he was going to plead for peace with the New York mob. But then he changed his mind and he did the ending that we saw at the ice cream parlor. And that's, you know, and we wound up talking about that for a very long time. And I don't think we came out of it with any clearer picture of what exactly happened. But I think for the first time, I feel very comfortable with what Chase's intentions were about what the scene means. And with a show like The Sopranos, I think that's a more interesting thing to consider than the plot.
And I absolutely love the debate you and Matt have entitled Don't Stop Believing, You Know Exactly What Happened at the End of The Sopranos. And some great theories in there, including this notion that because of the camera angles, Tony in some ways actually seeing himself in the scene, that maybe this is all a dream. And maybe the answer, one of the possible answers, is that he's dead even before they get to Holstein's.
That's entirely possible. The way he edited it was different from the way that any other, you know, episode of the series had been presented and almost any other scene had been presented. He broke a lot of sort of basic rules of cinematic grammar to give you that sense of disorientation and to have you asking these questions about, did he die? What's going on here? Why am I so scared when I'm watching Meadow Parallel Park? This should be really dull, and instead I'm on the edge of my seat.
And the bigger question is not what happened, but what does it mean? What do you think it means 20 years later?
I think it means whether or not you think he actually died or whether or not you think Meadow died or, you know, Chase was metaphorically whacking the audience or whatever. I think the scene's about death. It's about the idea that, you know, we are given these lives on temporary loan, and that loan can be called due at any moment without warning. And we all sort of travel through life understanding but not really wanting to think about that. And that scene is about sort of forcing you to confront that feeling and that knowledge for a little bit, and it's heightened because for a guy like Tony Soprano, the odds of him suddenly getting whacked are much greater than for the rest of us, but you never know. And it's certainly like, I was terrified when I watched it that night. Every time we rewatched it to do research for the book, I still felt that sense of dread, even though I knew exactly what was going to happen and what we weren't going to see. It's an amazing, one of the great endings of all time.
And callbacks are such a big part of this show, and even at the end there are callbacks to a number of earlier messages and possible hints, including what Bobby had said about death.
Yeah, and earlier in the season, Bobby says, you know, I bet when it comes, you don't even hear it happen, which a lot of the audience mistakenly remember as Bobby saying, I guess when you die, everything cuts to black, as their way to, you know, sort of solve the ending. And I don't think the ending is meant to be solved. It's just sort of meant to be felt.
I have to tell you, the research that you and Matt have done, the footnotes alone are worth the price of the book because there's so much great information. And I particularly love the way you guys trace and sort of sketch the biographies and the careers of some of the many, many actors who appeared in so many key roles in the series, their connections to not just Goodfellas, but much of American television and film over the last half century.
It's an amazing cast, and originally it started off, it was just a lot of people who'd been in Goodfellas and then a few other relatively unknown character actors like Gandolfini and Edie Falco, but the more successful the show became, the more access they had to different kinds of people, and so Joe Pantoliano could come in, Steve Buscemi could come in, all of these people, and it's wonderful.
The memories of the thoughts that you and Matt had about James Gandolfini, and of course, David Chase's eulogy, if anybody can read that and not tear up, they're a heck of a lot tougher than me. That was such a wonderful tribute to him.
Jim was a very mysterious but often really wonderful and warm-hearted guy. And very pathologically shy, which you would not think of both for someone in his profession and also someone who became famous for playing a character like this. But he loved acting, and he really didn't like the attention that came with it. And it was a really fascinating and bittersweet dichotomy to watch while he was still with us. And one of the more amazing things that's happened since the book came out is David Chase has now been working on this prequel movie, and they recently announced that Jim's son, Michael, is going to play young Tony at some point in this movie, The Many Saints of Newark, which I, like, that's, the son gets to literally step into the father's footsteps. That's beautiful.
Oh, and it sounds wonderful. Now, there were some discussions online, and it may have been on your Twitter feed, about the timeline for this, because that series takes place in the 60s when Tony would have been, 8, 9 years old, but yeah, obviously Michael's a lot older.
The first season set around the time that this movie is supposed to take place, and Tony's a little kid. But there's no rule that says the whole movie has to be set there, and it's supposed to be mainly about Christopher's father, Dickie, who dies when Christopher's a baby. So it could be a case of, like, we start off in the 60s and we move through the 70s and into the early 80s, you know, and we know around the time that Tony, you know, he was, I think, 22 when he killed his first guy to, you know, sort of, you know, break into the mob. We know around how old he was when he and Jackie robbed the card game, all of these things. So we could see little glimpses of that along the way. You know, Michael Gandolfini's 19, can look a little bit older or a little bit younger, but certainly cannot play Tony as a little kid. So I have to think the movie is going to cover more time than just 1967.
So as you look back 20 years to the start of this series and what it became and what it remains today among fans, hard to find any list of the greatest shows of all time that doesn't have The Sopranos somewhere in the top two or three. What's the legacy of this show in terms of its impact on creating television?
Like I said, TV now is not the way it is without The Sopranos. It might have some things in common, but, you know, television is a very imitative business. So you had this show. It was a huge hit. It broke all of these rules that TV had unwritten for 50 years. And suddenly executives said, oh, well, maybe we were wrong about all these things. And so you got a lot of shows that were very much like it, like Breaking Bad, like The Shield, like Mad Men, like The Wire, like Deadwood, and, you know, on and on, you know, through House of Cards and Ozark and things like that. So these shows are there specifically because of the success, but also just the larger sweep of what television has become. And the nice thing about this book is I feel like the show had been a little bit forgotten over the last few years just because it's not on Netflix and younger viewers only know what's on Netflix. And there was just more talk about the things that had followed it, like Breaking Bad and Mad Men. And it was sort of being like, oh, well, that's an important show, but, you know, I like these other ones better. And since the book came out, since the anniversary happened in early January, I've just heard a lot of people saying that this gave them an excuse to go back and watch again and, like we did, realize just how amazing The Sopranos is, and that's been really gratifying.
The book is a huge success on the New York Times bestseller list. Are you surprised at the reaction?
I'm very gratified by the reaction, and it's been nice to see because, you know, it's a 20-year-old show, and it's one of the great ones, but, you know, our culture is always very much about things in the moment. So to see that there's still this much love and this much attention for it has been great.
Alan Sepinwall, along with Matt Zoller Seitz, the author of The Sopranos Sessions, an absolute must-have if you're a fan of the show, and if you're not, read the book and you'll become a fan of the show. Alan, as always, it's a great to talk with you. We wish you continued success, and thank you so much for being with us.
Rich, it is my pleasure every single time. We'll talk soon.
Alan Sepinwall here on Downtown talking about The Sopranos Sessions.